This is Neil Orr, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Alden Lee on the 20th of October, 2009.
My name is Neil Orr. I was born in South India on the 4th of August, 1931.
Why were your parents in India?
My father was a medical missionary, and my mother's father had been a medical missionary as well. My father worked with David Somerville, who'd climbed Mount Everest, you remember, with Mallory and Irving. And when he came back through India, he was so appalled at the state of medicine, he said, I'm coming back here to work. And so he worked, you know, for 40 years in India. My father worked with him.
So you spent a lot of your childhood there?
No, we in those days, you weren't really expected to stay in India after the age of seven. My elder brother came back on his own at the age of seven in a boat. We're going to stay with his Glasgow cousins. My mother and I and my younger brother came back when I was six, I think. And then my father came back a year later because it wasn't considered healthy for young whites to live in the tropics of India in those days.
Were you therefore destined to be a doctor if it was in the family lineage?
I was. I wanted to be a doctor ever since I wanted to be an engine driver. Neither of my brothers had the slightest inclinations. There was no pressure or anything. It's just I always wanted to be not only a doctor, but a surgeon. I wanted to be a manual labourer.
Where did you gain your qualifications?
I was at Cambridge and St Thomas's. Cambridge, I was what they call preclinical, doing an MB. And then I went to Thomas's for my clinical work. And I went to Cambridge to get my degrees.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic?
My first brush was, I think, my 16th birthday, when a very good friend of my parents gave me a book on Edward Wilson of the Antarctic. And I was absolutely smitten with this man. And I became a great sort of heroic era fan, Scott and Wilson and so on, and thought that's the sort of thing I'd like to do. So I got to know about them quite a lot.
What was it about Wilson that really captured your imagination?
He was a man of action, a doctor, a man of action, sick man, TB, and went off to the Antarctic and did all these wonderful things. He was great moral support to everybody from Scott downwards, was a great watercolour painter, did a great faith. He was a man for all seasons, I think, and one of the few people that I really found didn't find any feet of clay. So I've always been a great admirer of him. I've gone off Scott quite a lot, but I've stayed with Wilson.
So how did your inkling about going to the Antarctic become reality? What happened?
Well, soon after I took my final exams at St Thomas's, I went off to an expedition to a little island called Socotra, which I'll not go into too much because nobody knows where it is, but I wandered around among the mountains of this island that no one visited that century. This was 1956, and it took bloods from troglodytes who lived in caves to see what their origins were. It was thought to be the Isle of the Terraces of Incense, and where the great incense trade that Egypt and things came from, just off Cape Gardafui. And people had never been near it because you couldn't get onto it. There are no harbours, and the monsoons bashed it one way of half the year and bashed it the other way of half the year. So we were flown onto there. And when I came back, Thomas's people said, oh, well, you lost all the best jobs, and you know, why did you go? Because it worked exactly the other way. We had a film on TV, and we had an article in Sunday Times, and you know, one had leapfrogged rather than retracted. And then about 18 months later, when I was working as a doctor, a very junior SHO at St Thomas's, Fids came to Thomas and said, we're looking for doctors to go to the Antarctic. And the secretary came to me and said, I just wonder if this is sort of thing you'd be interested in. I said, I'd be absolutely fascinated. He said, well, would you like to apply? And I said, yes, but not just at the moment, because I really got to get my feet onto the ladder. I'll consider it next year. So I went and saw the powers that be, Bunny, Fuchs and Co. And there was not much in the way of a big interview. They said, right, come along. And you'll have to get a trade, make some sort of program before you go. And it was recommended the Medical Research Council and so on. So during my last 6 months at St. Thomas's, that job, I used to go up to the Medical Research Council, then finally took 6 months working up a program on physiology. And so that was 6 months gone. Then I went away to the Antarctic for 2.5 years, and then came back again for another year to write up my MD thesis on the work that I'd done. So it really was 4 years out of my medical career.
Let's just go back a little bit. See, this interview that you went to, this is Fuchs, and was it Bill Sloman?
Yes, it would be Bill Sloman, I think.
It wasn't that rigorous then, you don't think?
Oh, absolutely not. In getting to know them later, I realised they said the important things to us, if a man has got a good career ahead of them and is making good progress in that career and is prepared to give it up to go to the Antarctic, then that's the right sort of chap for us.
Did you sense any psychoanalysis going on?
Well, that was the psychoanalysis, I think. No more than that. I mean, I'd played rugger for the hospital for 3 years, and I'd been on another expedition, and, you know, I was actually employed by the hospital. So each of those things showed that I was going well up my ladder, and I was prepared to drop it and go and do something else.
So they said, yes, they held the place for you, effectively.
Yes, that's right.
For a year.
Yes.
Did you discuss, or what point did you discuss the kind of work you might do down there, apart from patching up fallen FIDs?
Well, the fallen FIDs really was the least of the work, because fit young men in the ideal environment don't get ill when they didn't. They were just falling down crevasses and that sort of thing. So that, no, I think, I really can't think how I got started on it. They put me in touch with Julian Taylor, who you're going to meet later. He was very keen on nutrition of dogs and things. I think Fuchs had some ideas on nutrition and people losing weight, and which he reckoned, like Scott and Co., was all due to dehydration and not melting enough snow. And would I go and show and prove that it was dehydration and so on? Because the thesis, if we come to be more specialised, I've went into more detailed, was that people coming back from sledging journeys had always lost an enormous amount of weight, and they could come out, put it back on in a couple of days. So they just thought it, because they could come back to base and could turn on the tap and get picked down, bring down the beer and whatever it was, and just replace their fluid. And that was the obvious thing. So I was given, I worked out with various people in the MRC, which we can go into later if you like, that one could measure A, how much fluid they took, and B, how much they passed and where they concentrated their urine. One could also measure their skin fold thickness with special, and measure things on base and on field trips. And at the same time, we worked out a program with Ian Hampton, who was coming as a pure physiologist, in which he was interested in dehydration, and the people who went on the original Weddell Sea, the advanced part of the Transantarctic expedition, Fuchs, had done a lot of work on circulation extremities. And they'd noticed that after the end of the time, having built this hut in severe cold, they could do all sorts of things with their fingers they couldn't do before. So we were interested, or Jan found that he got really interested in the circulation and of the warmth and circulation And I did that with him, but it didn't grab me nearly as much as this food, because as soon as I went on a stage ship, my very first stage ship, I was just bloody hungry. And I said, well, if this is staging, I think it's bad news. And I really developed, and I began to see that really one was just not eating enough. And worked away at that until I can develop my ideas now. Over the 2 years, I found that people's body weights, which I kept a great, I've got it downstairs, the thing of the body weights of everyone on base as they came on base and so on, that purely from the base point of view, when they came off the ships and had a long 3 months across the Atlantic, they were all A, fat and heavy. Then 2 or 3 weeks of really intensive physical activity, working up the 24-hour day, getting stuff off the ships and on the ships, and before the ice came in, they got fitter and fitter, and their body weights went down, and their skin fold thickness went down. They stayed like that. And then in the winter, when they were sitting more on base, they went up again. So I see this all to do with activity, you see. And doing the same in the field, I found that people's body weights went down and down and down, as did their... But there wasn't really much change in their urine throughput or their fluid intake or anything. It was just actually calories. So the same I was doing with dogs, which is another thing I developed really quite separately. But dogs thrived on seal meat, which they were fed on alternate days, about 7 to 9 pounds. We used to saw the seals up with a felling axe, they were all frozen, and then chop them, and you chop them round, up. And they thrived on that, though it wasn't very good for their coats. And then when they were sent in the field, they were given a diet of Nutricon, which replaced pemmican. And they were interested to see if they were absorbing this properly and using just a pound of pemmican and Nutricon a day as opposed to 7 to 9 pounds of seal meat on alternate days. So I was weighing them. And so I found that the ones who were only getting the pound a day were losing condition and losing discipline and behaving very much like those dogs on Scott's expeditions who didn't understand dogs at all. And but they put it all down to indiscipline. And I just reckoned that there was not enough food. So finally, at my end of my second year, I ran 3 teams all together. And one of us fed our teams on the routine diet, another fed their team on 1.5 the diet, another fed their team on twice the diet. And after, and we were laying depots and working really quite hard and travelling long distance, after 2 or 3 weeks, really the one on the normal diet were totally indisciplined and very difficult to drive, very difficult to control, and really the one on two were perfectly disciplined and did all the leading in the end, because they were just better fit. So it just showed if you fed people and dogs properly, they performed better. At the same time, I went on a long trip with Fritz Kerner, who I became great friends with, and he thought much the same ideas as myself. And we went on a routine trip laying depots right down the sea ice and up on the big glacier, losing weight like mad. And after a couple of weeks, all we dreamt about, like Scott and fruit, was what we were going to eat, and you know what we'd have our perfect meal and lovely things we'd. And then I said, tomorrow we'll eat exactly what we like. We took and take enough food to do that, and we sort of had fanciful ideas about what we'd have and so on. And I ate 9,000 calories the next day. And the routine was 3, you see. I ate 9,000, and between us, and we each ate 23 apple fritters, which was really quite something. We took dehydrated apples, one of our little sort of perks, and we had 23 apple fritters, and we had lots of pot. We just gorged ourselves. And so the first day I ate 9,000 calories, second day 6,000 calories, and came down. And we went on eating just what we liked, and we ended up eating 5,500 calories a day. That kept our body weight steady, and we were much, the morale was better, we could do work better, we could concentrate better, and we found that 5,500 for everybody laterally was the ideal diet. And you'll find that that's what Olympic growing age or lumberjacks use, and what most of the modern Antarctic explorers will eat, at least 5,000 or 6,000 calories a day.
Did you find yourself on a collision course, therefore, with Fuchs and the FID hierarchy, who were obviously less?
Yeah, yeah.
How did that resolve itself?
Well, they got more.
Well, so they took your advice?
Yes, they did, basically.
So sledging rations were increased and improved?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, quite definitely.
So getting more food was not the problem?
Well, I mean, latterly one was much better equipped with backup in the way of radio for depots and things. And, of course, latterly dogs were removed altogether, so you weren't worrying about nutrient, you were worrying about diesel, which wasn't considered to be eco-non-friendly, whereas dogs were mad thinking, but still, that's a different story. But they certainly get very much more food now.
Thanks to you.
Well,
you were the man at that time doing
that
work.
Yeah, that's right.
It could have been somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I quite understand. Let's just go back a bit. Did you travel down on the Shackleton?
Yes.
So that was where you were docked on ship?
Yes. That was very interesting. That'll take a lot.
What was that?
Well, there was I, an SHO in a London hospital.
SHO?
Yeah. Oh, that's senior house officer. I mean, right. Pretty junior stuff, just one up from a house surgeon. 18 months qualified and extremely naive, except we had fairly lively patients from Lambeth who came into our casualty department. We learned a certain amount of low life, but wasn't really used to the problems that sailors get when they go ashore travelling, you know, foreign parts and things. And that was quite interesting. And then, of course, at the end, when we got to the Antarctic, we visited all the bases and all the ones who hadn't got doctors. Then I was able to check their medical problems and because only the bigger bases, I think there were only three bases in the Antarctic, had a doctor at the time. And we had various interesting cases, which I can tell you about.
Yes, that'd be interesting.
One was we heard of a small base, whose life was totally disrupted by a case of appendicitis. And this lad, who actually was the base leader, had the wireless Port Stanley when the ice had come in, saying that he got pains in his abdomen. And Dr. Sladen was there and said, well, did poke it here and press it there and you feel sick, and all the questions you'd ask them. And because he was anxious, he would say, yes, it hurts, and so Sladen said, well, it sounds very much as though you've got appendicitis. I should go to bed and take antibiotics. So they put him in his bunk, and all the plans of base work that year were kiboshed, I may say, because they were meaning to travel a bit. And every time a ship got near him, the Chileans and the HMS Protector and things, all trying to get down, send in helicopters and get there. As they approached, he got better. And as they had to withdraw because the conditions, he got worse. So when we actually got there with the Shackleton, I thought we were going to find a really quite sick chap. And so we went ashore and took a sledge and dog team and sleeping bags and things. And there he was in the base, looking rather like the old man at sea, with a long, long beard and long, long hair. And I examined him very carefully. And I couldn't find anything wrong with him at all. Anyway, we put him on a sledge and brought him back to the Shackleton and hoisted him on board, and it was just coming up for lunchtime, so I said, well, no point staying in your sleeping bag, but come and have some lunch. He said, I like that. I said, what about a gin before? He said, well, I like that too. So he had a couple of good gins and went down and had a good lunch. And after lunch, it would be a good idea if I cut your hair, because I became the barber on the ship and so. cut your hair and trimmed your beard, and cut his hair and trimmed his beard. And he never looked back. And it was just, you know, how not having the security of genuine medical advice, you can get things right out of proportion. And it really did bugger up the base for that year, I understand.
You're avoiding saying the name of the person on the base.
Can't even remember.
Oh, okay, fine. All right.
I have no. I've got diaries, and I look back at my diaries about this, and I think I have got his name in there, but it really is irrelevant.
I was judging by what you told Amanda. I was surprised there was any gin left on the boat.
Oh, that's you're talking. The Fids had their own gin. And if you're talking about Captain Blackburn, who was an ex-naval captain and retired, and he had no ice experience at all. And as far as he's concerned, ice was some friendly stuff that floated around on top of his gin. And he would bash it backwards and forwards, trying to break his way through. And he broke the rudder, bent the rudder. So we had to go back to Falkland Islands, and the surveyors had looked at it and said, "Well, you have to go back to Montevideo and get new rudder." And as I was the doctor on board, I had to go back with them instead of getting off at Hope Bay when I should have done. And as Captain Blackburn had brought his wife with him and left her in Stanley, we found in Stanley that there was many gin bottles, there were milk bottles at her back door, and she by that time got the DTs. So this is a new notch to my quiver dealing with my first really serious gin person. And she'd rush around the deck and with nothing on except her husband's dressing gown, which was open at the front, saying, "I am the captain's wife, lure the ships, lure the ships." And all I found I could do for the 3 days that we were travelling out to Monte was play cribbage with her or la dice and drink gin. And I would pour her a small gin and me virtually no gin. We both like pink gin, so I put an Angostura. And we played cribbage and I just eventually put no gin in at all, but she did that. And then it was extremely difficult to get her into a proper medical establishment with her connivance or admission, but we did, and she went in and she had very good treatment
in Monte,
very good treatment, and she sent me a very nice message saying thank you very very much, you've been a great help, and from him, so they appreciated. But it was interesting. But we had our own gin in the Fids office, Fids mess, and the officers had their gin up there, so that didn't cross. We did.
Looking back on these early escapades, were you taking it all in your stride, or were you at all concerned or nervous, or was it a young man's bravado that you could do anything?
I was fairly confident. I mean, there was no one to go to. I mean, it wasn't as though I could say help. I was suddenly found myself on my own. And I also found myself being treated with respect much higher than I deserved. I mean, the first officers and the captain and things would ask my advice about medical things, and then when we got very good friends, asked my advice about all sorts of things. And as the medical officer, one found oneself not only... And I just found myself very friendly, very good friends with people all up and down. A tremendous entree being a doctor. And I became very good friends with Bill Sladen, the doctor in Port Stanley. I got really quite friendly with Arrowsmith, who was the governor. And he gave me introductions to people in South Africa and things on the way back. And I just found it opened doors to all sorts of people. And I helped my self-confidence immensely.
Did you have a decent library to turn to?
Oh, yes. Ship's Captain Medical Guide is marvellous. And we had very good library. And, of course, once I'd established very good rapport with Dr. Sladen, I could always refer straight back to him if there were problems.
And did that library go with you to Hope Bay, or were you?
The library at Hope, yes, no, Hope Bay had. We were equipped like a destroyer. Apparently, we were equipped exactly the same as a destroyer, with the surgical instruments and a library comparable to an MO on a destroyer.
So what did you have to do at Hope Bay? Did you have broken bones to deal with?
Well, as I say, I had no illnesses, because fit young men in an ideal environment don't get ill. We had the odd Ian Hampton dropped down a crevasse quite a long way from base and dislocated his shoulder and split his skull. The dog man who was with him, Ron Tyndall, sewed up his skull quite very, very expertly with, I think, twine from to made the dog's harnesses with, but I can't remember, but they healed up extremely well. And then we had to go down, Keith Allen and I, on it with a sledge to bring him back. And that was called the Mercy Dash, and it was really a very interesting and rather exciting trip.
Do you want to
elaborate? Yes, because I was in the... My second year, I was base leader. The first year, I can talk about dogs later, but I had trained a team up from puppies, and we travelled a couple of thousand miles together and were the greatest friends, my dogs and I. The second year, I really wasn't able to travel nearly so much because I was very responsible, felt very conscious of my responsibilities for the logistics of the base. And so was and the ships coming in and out when they came, and whereas the ships came in and out, normally we'd all get off base if we possibly could, because the last thing we wanted was the disruption of ships. But I had to be there, and that sort of thing. So I really hadn't travelled as much. And I said, well, before the end of the season, I'm going to get one decent trip. And I went off with Adrian Allen, who was a geophysicist. And I couldn't ever get to grips with radio much. So our radio skeds were just on time and as brief as possible. And I certainly didn't keep the radio running or anything like that anymore. And I keep my mobile phone on nowadays. It's something totally foreign to me. And they found it very difficult to get hold of me when Ian fell down the crevasse, because he fell down just after our radio skid, and there wasn't another one for 3 days or anything. So they had to come out from base, for I wasn't too far from base, and tell me about it. And so Keith Allen and I took off straight away down to where they were, and with our radios on. And I do remember there was just the two of us and one team, that was my team. And I think that certainly we stopped on sea ice, which was a thing which we never did if we could possibly avoid it.
Because, you mean stay the night?
Yes, because there were plenty of previous things I can tell you about where sea ice had gone out and people had gone out with it and not come back and so on. And the blizzard came down in the evening and we were on the sea ice and there was no question of coming back because we had to press on. So we just said, well, right, we'll have to camp on the sea ice. And all during the night we could hear creaks and groans and huffs and puffs and, oh, my God, the sea ice is breaking up. But the next morning it had cleared and we saw we'd camped just within 50 yards or so of a blowhole that killer whales made about 50 miles away from the nearest open sea. And they keep blowholes open, they can come up. And there were the killer whales huffing and puffing there in their blowholes. And if we'd gone on another 50 yards, we'd have dropped straight in and made nice supper for them. But we avoided that. And then we found, it was some days, a week or so, I suppose, after the accident, we got to their camp, and they'd stayed there. And Ian was in really very good order, and his head had healed beautifully, and he just got this dislocated arm. So we'd strapped him in a sledge in his sleeping bag and came back. We were three trips, three stages on that. time as Bill Tracy and Keith Allen. No, Bill Tracy and Ron Tyndall and Keith and Ian on the third stage with Ron Tyndall. And we were coming back over one of the islands and then down a glacier. And it was really nice, easy sledging. And I looked round, I shouted to Bill, I said, "Where's Ron?" And he's just behind. I look, he's not, you know. And he and his team and Ian Hampton had all dropped down a crevasse. No, the team hadn't. They were just the sledge. And Ron Tyndall was driving it, and the patient had dropped down a crevasse. And by the time we got back there, Ron had climbed out, because we always tied on, at least we hooked on, with a safety harness, and his hadn't slipped off, because the handlebars had jammed just near the top, because the stage had turned over and the handlebars jammed. And Ron was climbing up, muttering very strong Scottish oaths. And Ian was complaining about the snow going down the back of his neck and his sleeping bag. And he was, of course, immobile to do anything. So we got them out. And I said, when we got them out and we were all settling, I always used to carry a flask of rum on the handlebars of my sledge. I had a flask of rum and some binoculars and my sealing knife. I always had the sealing knife there so I could cut traces if dog went down. And I offered him a slug of my rum. And he is a physiologist. "Oh, no, you can't have alcohol on the mountainside." So I had his share and he had a cigarette. So much for his physiological ideas. So that was that little excitement. And then the other one coming back with Fritz Kerner after we'd travelled with these dogs very hard and they were lost a lot of weight. Mac went down a crevasse, one of the dogs, and when we looked down, he was hanging in his harness, not too far below. And as we pulled him up, came up to the brink of the crevasse, and as he got up to the top, he put his 4 feet up above his head to try and get up, and of course he dropped out of his harness down, right down the crevasse, down onto a shelf long way below. And so I went down, it was just Fritz and I, and I read it with 2 people, it's quite tricky. I went down and tied him onto, and Fritz pulled him up and so on. And that was because he was rather thin, he'd been on the normal diet. And then I climbed out afterwards, which I could perfectly well do as I was perfect compass and perfectly fit. But if you drop down and lost consciousness, there was really almost nothing that just 2 people could do. It's a thing we used to discuss a lot. With all these, so that was another crevasse incident we had.
A couple of supplementaries then. One is, why did you feel the imperative to go and rescue the dog? Is that what one did?
Well, yes. I mean, it's quite as dear to me as anyone else. We didn't even. I wouldn't.
So. And how did you repair Ian's arm?
Well, then that was. I did have to get into. We got him back to base. And the Argentinians had a base 200 yards away, and they had an X-ray machine. So we were able to take an X-ray and show he got a fracture dislocation of his elbow. So then I got into touch, I got out my books, I got in touch with Bill Sladen, and we set up a little operating theatre in the base hut. And the dog man, Ron Tyndall, administered, I think, the pentothal, the general anaesthetic. I gave it, and he just... And I gave it a good tweak, having read all my books and got my advice. And it came back perfectly well. And slowly we mobilised it, and it really was... He was not a lot worse off. You can ask him about that tomorrow.
Was the Argentinian X-ray machine actually operational when you first...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
It was.
they could make it work. They had all the gear, but they didn't actually do any work. I could tell you more stories about this. But if you want to stick on crevasse stories, just while we're there, on another base, they a chap, two of them were up on a col, and the chap dropped down a crevasse. And we used to discuss and argue endlessly about whether you had a safety harness fixing you to a sledge, or whether one you could didn't have a safety harness that you could let the sledge go, or whether you had one that you hooked on. You ended up hooking on, but always wearing a safety harness. Anyway, he dropped down a crevasse, and his mate dropped a climbing rope down to him, and instead of putting on wearing a proper harness, he just tied it onto his belt. And then, of course, one man can't pull one man out of a crevasse, because when you get to the top, you've got a shelf to go over. Anyway, he tied it to his dog team, and the dogs, who weren't very well disciplined, just roared down the hill, and he popped out of this crevasse like a cork out of a bottle. But the rope cut through the shelf. And, of course, as he came and hit the shelf, the belt broke, and he dropped, and the belt came out like a cork out of a bottle, and he dropped down the crevasse, and that was the end of him. And all we got of that was, you know, medical advice over the radio. I mean, there was nothing one could do, but it was a very, very salutary and very sad tale. And we had things like that. You see, being the medical officer in the area, one would get, and there was another one, somebody who dropped off a mountain and was killed as well. So we had that, and really it was a question of maintaining morale as much as anything in these tragedies, and the terrible loss of nerve of the people on the base and so on.
Is that a doctor's job to contribute towards the recovery of the psychology?
I think so, yes. What I found with the disasters, we'll go to more jolly things now, but one day I was in my little tiny surgery, and late at night, and Ron Tiddle, the dog man, came in. He's a great friend of mine. He said, "God, what are you laughing about?" I said, "Well, I'm just reading The Debunking of Tigger in Winnie the Pooh." "Good God," he said. I said, "Well, listen to this." And I read it, and he thought it was hilarious. So I went in to say, they said, "Come and read it," the chaps. And they were all in their bunks. We all slept, 15 of us, round the main rain thing. And I sat at the stove in the middle reading The Debunking of Tigger to all these rugged chaps. And they thought they were hilariously funny. And at moments of crisis like that, it became the sort of tradition, like when we had a fire in the hut and we'd all cleared and morale had dropped, I would be asked to go and read Winnie the Pooh story to them all, to let them know that life would go on. And it became a sort of tradition, really. And in moments like that, one end up reading a Pooh story or something, really.
The Debunking of Tigger was a genuine Milne story, or is that just the Fid's name for it?
Oh, no, it's a genuine Milne. Oh, yes, you don't know your Winnie the Pooh.
I thought I did, but I haven't come across that particular oomphra.
I'll tell you about it. Anyway.
Were you doing psychological studies on the Milne?
No, I had no.
What were the psychological problems that came up, though, apart from in the wake of something disastrous?
I think you begin to realise that people... things made much more impression on them than they thought they ought to. And a lot of them were very rugged Lakeland or Scottish mountaineers and things. But they found themselves against things that they really hadn't come across. And one or two really did all sorts of things not to travel on the mainland, because they got shit scared of crevasses. Others were really got very frightened of sea ice and would do all they possibly could not to travel on the sea ice. And I began to realize these things. And of course, latterly, the second year when I was base leader and mobilizing them, I was able to shift them around as appropriate. It was very good from my point of view, seeing people coming up against their limitations, which very often came as a surprise to them, and very often they wouldn't admit to, but one could see them happening, and with one or two good friends on the base, one could discuss them and realize that this really was their problem, or they could come to you and say, I think really he's very frightened of and doesn't want to do this, and so one would learn.
These were genuine phobias, were they?
Yes, well, you came against your limitations, which you didn't like to admit as big, strong, outgoing chaps, that you didn't like it, and so you thought of all sorts of reasons why you shouldn't do that, but really you were just frightened of the situation.
So would they come to the doctor and say, I'm sorry, I don't want to do this?
No.
They'd just find excuses for not doing it, and you'd spot the string of excuses.
Yeah, and it wasn't as a doctor, it really was as a base leader, a chap who was playing with men, where the doctor was just a sort of, I didn't think it's real, psychology I hadn't done a lot of at Thomas's. Psychology always happened on a Saturday morning, and I was off training playing rugger somewhere. So I didn't do much psychology, but I got to know about people quite a lot. Mm.
Did these phobias arise from incidents that other people,
Yes.
Either to themselves or to other people, yes. They knew that somebody had gone down a crevasse and not come back?
Yes, it shook them quite a lot. And we all had incidents, near incidents, we talked about them a lot. And I remember another one, I was travelling with Fritz Kerner up a glacier, doing glaciology, because as a doctor, I travel just to be a support to the other, drive the dogs. And we were sitting there in a blizzard for a few days, and getting a bit bored with that. And one of the things he used to do was dig a snow hole until he got to the ice, and then he'd measure the ice and do all sorts of things, clever things to the ice. I said, well, I'll go and start digging a snow hole. So I went out in the blizzard and started digging a hole, snow hole, just outside the base, outside the tent, and dug and dug and dug, and I got about 6 feet. So I was well under, the blizzard was blowing above me, and I was shoveling snow out. I shouted out, Fritz, I said, Fritz, I'm just not getting it. It's very, very steep snow. So I'll just push my ice axe down and see if I can hit snow, ice, and I can't, I'm going to give up. So I was down there, 6 foot down, and I've got I said, pass an ice axe down. And so he passed one, and I shoved it down. The whole of the floor of this below me fell away. And I was digging down a crevasse bridge, you see. I got out of that very quickly. And we were camping on a crevasse bridge. And that's worrying stuff. I mean, you don't feel totally secure anywhere when you've got all that, because just looking down, what I fell away from it was quite daunting. So any sort of incident like that or dog, it just brought you up that things could happen.
Do these result in behavioural problems or just?
No idea.
Or just reluctance to do certain things?
I think if one hadn't been aware of it and had forced them into things, they would have come out in a rash or whatever. But I think if you could see that this was a problem, you could keep them away from that or support them in a way that they wouldn't be too aware of it. Or sometimes it was a responsibility they didn't like. And so you put them with somebody who could take over certain responsibilities for them.
There were at times, I think there were 15 bunks on this base, weren't
yes.
there? Yes. And I gather there were at times more than 15 people.
Well, the second year there were 19 people. The first year there were 19 people. We were never, ever together on the base at once. And I think 50% of the time we were out in the field. and being far enough north to able to travel the whole year round up in what the more rugged people further south would call the banana belt, we could lay depots and things in the summer, in the winter, where the sea ice was nice and firm, and you could travel great distances, and it was ideal for laying depots that you could then use in the summer. So we travelled the whole year round, and we were, as I say, out off base, never all together on base at the same time. And it's probably why we maintained the morale that we did and had such a very, very happy, productive base, that you come back, tell your tales of daring do, mend your sledges and plan your thing and push off again. And most people like to be on a sledging base like ours. Life was about being away out in the field, and not sitting on our bums in base, which wasn't, you know. There were one or two people who came thinking they knew about everything, and that the life of the sledging was going to be, you know, ex-marine I can think of particularly, and he'd been everywhere and been down every sort of crest, climbed every sort of mountain, been under, and he actually couldn't do anything. He could talk about it. And he was very keen to drive my dog team. So I thought, well, he's an ideal chap. You know, he's a chap who's very experienced. And I started teaching him, taking him over my dog team. And one day, he said, there's just a little trip they're going to do for a couple of days. And I said, well, you take it and see how you get on. And it was a beautifully trained dog. And within 24 hours, they were fighting, scratching, doing each other damage, and the other chaps got back on the base and said, you cannot have Dave driving this boat time. He tries to drive them as though they're on a parade square. The dogs have lost all confidence with everybody, and I think they're going to do themselves all damage, which, of course, was very, very bad for me and my relationship with the young man in question. And I'm afraid he ended up at another base.
Tell me about your team. What were they called?
It was called the Terrors.
The Terrors?
Yeah. Well, they were... When I arrived there, there were 100 dogs on base, which was nine or 10 teams. And all there were the four little puppies. So seven little puppies of 4 months each, and another one of 6 months. And they really hadn't been put into any sort of training at all. And at 4 months, we tended to put them in their harnesses and train them with other dog teams. But there wasn't another dog team. And there's just this one of 6 months who was a very intelligent dog. And so we just trained each other. I don't like dogs. I don't like domestic dogs. And I wondered how I was going to cope with all this situation, because domestic dogs here, I mean, the little ones sniff around your ankles and pee on your trousers, and the big ones shove their wet noses up your crutch and all that. I mean, they're not my scene at all.
I concur entirely.
And I realised that these were rather special, and I threw myself into it, body and soul, and I drove them every single day, one or two of them, every single day, while, unless it was blizzing so much, you just couldn't take them out. And I drove them every day. And I drove them for 3,500 miles. So they taught me a lot, and I taught myself a lot, and I taught them. So we just knew each other very, very well. And they were called the Terrors to begin with, because they were, you see, they were totally, they're just untrained, just they and me. And people like Don McCalman, who was base leader in that, were terrified, you know, that the whole thing was going to be shambles. But it wasn't. It developed into a really super little team. And then we had all the discussions about centre trace and fan trace and that sort of thing, which, of course, kept us occupied when we weren't talking about crevasses and other things. Or what were we going to do with the loo paper when you went out have shit in the blizzard. Anyway, I'll not go into all that, but there were certain things that occupied our minds. And I started drawing on fan trace, which is what they do in the north, in the Arctic. And the Bill Sladen people years ago in the BGLA, he who'd been trained in the north, ran their dogs on Fair and Trace, and it seemed to me to make a lot of sense that each dog is pulling on one separate bit of string on the sledge, and they're not pulling on against each other, against the centre trace, they're pulling individually. So I asked Don if I could develop this, and he said, well, with great reluctance he let me do it, and it obviously worked, as long as the dogs were well trained. And the time we'd finished, and after, I think more than half the teams run on Fair and Trace. But it did mean you had to have somebody who knew how to drive dogs, and dogs who were properly trained and had confidence in you. Otherwise, it can end up in a sort of total maypole shambles. But that was the sort of thing that occupied one all the time. And not
apart from the occasion where you camped on sea ice because you had to, did you take risks, or were you completely risk averse?
No, we took risks. But I can't remember any other. I mean, I can remember being pretty anxious. And we weren't stupid. I mean, if we went off travelling, we went off anywhere, we always were on a line or on a, initially we may have been a bit. I mean, I had an exciting time. We really were very careful, and that's one of the reasons Hope Bay was well trained like that. And if you went out to collect seals off ice floes coming into the bay, you always let the other people on the base know that you're taking a dinghy out. You always check that the dinghy worked and the spare and the outboard worked and the spare outboard worked, because if your outboard let you down and you were just taken over by the currents, you were off to Elephant Island or somewhere, and there's nothing anyone could do about it. So you were jolly careful. I do remember once taking some sea ice temperatures for Fritz Kader, who was a glaciologist, I told you, because he was in the field, and I went down with three of my dogs down to the ice edge and was trying to take the ice temperature. And it's about 3 foot down from the ice edge down to the water. And the penguins, leap in and out and so on. But I couldn't quite reach it. And there was a little ledge down there, which I stupidly put my foot on. The ledge gave way and I was in the water, swimming around there with nothing but a bit of sheer ice in front of me for about 3 feet. No ground to stand on and nothing to get. And my dogs looking over the edge saying, what the hell are you doing there? Stupid place you to be. And that really was rather frightening. But anyway, I got out and raced up to Basin. I couldn't, and poured myself a large gin or scotch, I think, and took
off. This is before the phrase health and safety came into popular usage, but I guess that's what you were doing, was it? Assessing risks and so on?
Oh, yes.
Employing your own health and safety?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Health and bloody safety. I mean, you would. But you see, the other thing we'd learned, you learn by these mistakes. And the things they'd learned, you've probably heard already about the fire in the other hut.
The first
hut at Hope Bay was an Isn hut, which is there still. And about some years, just when BGLE, when Dr. Sladen, or Sladen, I think, was the doctor, he was out in the penguin rookery doing some work on penguins, because the big, big penguin rookery at Dave. The rest of the team were in the field in their sledges, except for two chaps who were in the base. Mm-hmm. And the doctor looked back and saw the base was on fire and rushed back to the base, but couldn't get the door open because the doors opened outwards and the doors drifted up. So, and two chaps died, and their crosses are still there. And then the fire swept, the wind took it right across, so it took all the anthracite, all the spares, all the stores. And he had to live on, I don't know, half a paraffin primers of paraffin or something, and penguin blubber till Luke's got back from the field. So they'd learned, A, you don't have your doors going outward, B, that you have your anthracite miles away or to leeward, and the same for your... And so our things were all higgledy-piggledy, and also up on the coal so that the thing didn't drift up in the same way. And all these you learn from your own advice.
And do you think these lessons were passed on from year to year to year?
Oh, yes.
So when you went down several years later, you were warned about these...
That's right. And you tried to pass them on.
Yeah.
And not always were they received, because we had another tale with a whole lot of Marines who came off the Protector. And I went on board the Protector and we met the Marine officer and the captain. He said, they all want to go and climb mountains. They want to climb rocks. Can they go? I said, well, I thought about it and I had a talk with the surveyors. And they said, well, the Mondor Glacier is a place to go. Although we got lots and lots of climbers, none of them liked climbing because the rock was pretty unsafe and they were always busy doing something else. But anyway, they said, right, we'll come across, and I showed them on the map where the Mondor Glacier was, and it was about 2 hours away from base. And there were only three of us on base, Ron Miller, Ron Tyndall and I. And they said, well, we'll fly our Marines, or 200 Marines will be coming on tomorrow, we'll fly them on helicopters. And sure enough, the next day, there they came, and they were faffing around up in the, above us in the, on the hillside. And I got, and I said, would you like us to come and give you a hand with our dog teams? Good heavens, no, we're Marines, we know about this sort of thing. Good training for them. And we'll be off. And 2 hours later, they were still faffing around. So I said, well, are you sure you wouldn't like a hand? Well, I think we would. I think we'd just give us a lift round to the glacier, would you? So Ron Tyndall and I took our two teams up and left Ron Miller on his own, I think. And took them round to the Mondor Glacier, and they put all their man-to-hell sledges on behind and towed along behind us. And we got to the Mondor Glacier, and it started to blizzard a bit. So we said, well, we'll not go back tonight. We'd always, whenever we went out with this team, we always had emergency supplies on. So we fed our dogs, and we put our tent up, and we got the kettle on and got the brew up going, and there was tremendous coming and going outside, just, you know, all these chaps. And we looked out and we were right-hand man of 9 tents, all the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And when the officer and our dogs were all lying down, having been fed and put, and we were just having our first brew, and he came in and joined us, I said, that's sensible. I mean, you'll all drift up. And he said, no, we always do things. It's the way we do things. So the next day, 2 days later, it was still blizzing. And they were drifting up, I must say. And poor Ron was on his own at base. So I said, well, we'll have to go back. We'll go back on a compass course. So we took our tents down and on a compass course went back to base. And arrived there and got on with whatever we were doing. We were stripping the place down, replacing the bathroom, I remember, doing the plumbing. And 2 days later, the Protector came in, the bay, and they said, where are our Marines? And I said, well, they're on the Mondor Glacier. And they said, well, they're not there now. They've abandoned their camp. And there we looked up the hill, and there we're coming over the down 43T, which is a big steep slope behind Hope Bay, where the Marines pulling very light manhole sledges, certainly not laden. And what had happened, they had drifted up. They'd had to cut themselves out of the tops of their tents. They'd abandoned all their equipment and just been able to dig their manhole sledges. And they couldn't save their tents or anything. They just came back on their own. So there they arrived on base. And again, the Protector had to go out because it was blizzing. And it always blew very hard in Hope Bay. And so the Marines had a lovely time, and we were very pleased to have them. I mean, there were jolly sight more than 15 of them. But a lot of them were plumbers and painters and decorators. They re-plumbed our loo and thought the whole thing was tremendous fun. And I was cooking away like mad for these chaps. And then we thought we'd better go and have a look at the camp where the blizzard settled down. So the captains of the Marines and Ron and I and our dog teams, we went whizzing, just right round to the Mondor Glacier. And you could not see a vestige of a camp. You wouldn't have known the one was there. It was totally, totally covered over. And we never saw it again. And they had to bend all that equipment. My emergency come up now. But they had to go back to their protector with the tails between their legs. And a lot of them were much happier, stayed on base and done the things we were doing. They thought it was a terrific life. They enjoyed that very much. But it was jolly hard work keeping them fed and watered, I must say.
A couple of final questions, if I may. Mm. How does that 3-year spell in your life now rate in terms of life experience? Now you're
right at the very top.
I mean, why would you say that? What was so special?
Well, it was being your own person completely and not hampered by health and bloody safety and all the things we get now. And if things succeeded, it was because of you made them succeed. You were battling with probably one of the harshest environments in the world and enjoying it. It was a challenge, you know, and if you came up to beat that challenge, it was very, very rewarding. I really can't think of anything more than that. I mean, it's just that you push yourself to the limits and found that your limits were quite a long way away.
Were you a different man coming north to the one who went south?
I think I was, but I mean, they're so very interesting. Tell us all about it. And once you've got about 2 minutes into discussion, you could see a thin veil come over their eyes. I've lectured about it a lot since then, and people enjoy their lectures, and I'm in fact doing another one in December. I love talking about it, but actually talking to people other than people like yourself who come here, especially, I very rarely find they're frightfully interested. They're all much more interested in themselves. Just the same way we were just interested in ourselves when our families had their yearly talk to us about the thing. You know, we'd really much sooner be out in the field than hearing about the daffodils and Hyde Park and all that.
In what ways were you different after those 2.5 years? Excuse me.
I got a lot of more confidence, I think. Well, I just don't know. I just loved it. You were fulfilled. You could do things and push yourself to your limits, which I enjoy doing.
Neil, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Have I covered the ground enough for you?